G'day, Groovers. Welcome to another instalment of the U Project. Craig Anthony Harper, Melissa Marie Cameron over there at bloody U Project Central. Hello. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon to you too. How are you going?
Oh, look, I'm good. And you know what? I've done no prep today for this. You know why I've done no prep? Because I need to, because I know the bloke. And there's going to be no hard-hitting interview. There's just going to be two middle-aged fuckers just waffling on for about 30 minutes and catching up, which really should have been done face-to-face in a cafe, but we went, fuck it, let's kill two birds with one stone. Hello, Frankie.
Hey, Craig Anthony Harper. How are you going?
Mate, I'm very good. Look at you in your... Melissa, can you take a screenshot of us good-looking bastards?
Sure.
Because look what's there in the background. That's a very full-looking library, mate. Where is that? Is that the dungeon? What is that?
Yeah, it's almost. I think. Am I heading into hoarding territory? Do you think?
You look like one of those weirdos that I see on Channel 31 at about 9:30 most nights of the week.
Yeah, I know. I try to live a minimalist life. No, I don't. I'm terrible. I just buy stuff and keep it. Books and records, Craig, are my thing. And I've got a big shelf full of both. Which, you know, some people would be freaked out by that. It's like it is just too much stuff. But I kind of I'm passionate about this stuff. So I like being surrounded by it. And since I've been working from home, it's kind of nice. So, you know, I'm a writer by trade these days, or do some podcasty broadcast stuff as well. And when I'm writing and being creative, I just put a record on and, you know, think away and write away and, you know, hey, do the thing I love and listen to some music.
Why not, dude?
And is it?
You know what I think about books? I've got at the end of my little table that I, with all the mics and bullshit here, is about 50 books just stacked. I think books have an energy about them. And when I'm around books that I love, which people are going to go, that's weird, don't care. There's like they energize me. And music's exactly the same. Music has a physiological impact. And I mean, that's not even a theory. That's science. It does something to one's soul and mind, I think, Francis.
Yeah, particularly, I mean, you like me, I get excited by new ideas, new thoughts and people expressing themselves. And I only have one pair of eyes and one pair of ears, which is frustrating because I'd like to be able to absorb it all of the time. And I think my little stack of books is here. I'm about to go away on holidays for a week and I've got to choose between...
Oh, God. Now, for those who can't see, which is all of us, he's just...
books.
He's just reached around. By the way, behind Francis is 15,000 books on 400 shelves, and he's just grabbed four of the fattest books ever. What are they?
Well, there's one of them is Magda Zabanti's book, Reckoning, which is the amazing tale of her father.
Wow.
Her father, who was a refugee from Poland after World War II and was revealed to Magda as she grew up, that he was actually a very famous part of the Polish resistance. And she quite openly refers to him as an assassin. And you would never have known meeting Mr. Zabanski, and I never met him, but just by reading this and seeing the interview, that his job in the Polish resistance was to kill Nazis. And when they asked, he talks about it quite openly. So that's one that I really want to read. And this is the other one that I'm thinking about taking, which is Douglas Stewart's book called Shuki Bain, which is a winner of the Booker Prize last year, which is a novel set in Glasgow in 1981, which would have been fairly grim times for the poor working class of Glasgow, but apparently it's an amazing book. So they're the two that I'm going to take, I've decided, and take and try to at least start reading. I'll try to read a novel and some non-fiction to balance out both sides of the brain. Try to read two books at once. Not literally at once, but, you know, pick one up. Yeah.
So that's tell you, if you can read two books at once, you're going into new territory, and I might take you to Monash Uni, and we might slide you into the bloody CT scanner and see what's
happening.
Look, you
can do it.
Brain.
Look, one eye each. You just sort of like hold them both up at the same time and try to. No. Also, you know, bounce between the two of them.
I love autobiographical stuff, just because I love fiction too. But I seem, maybe because I'm lazy, I seem to love movies more than fiction books. But it's probably one of my favourite books ever you gave me. I think we spoke about this once on a podcast, did we?
Yes, the Angry White Pyjamas.
Bloody great book.
Right.
Bloody great book. Everybody,
you
if you haven't.
True unless you were told it was true, that book.
Say again?
You wouldn't believe the story was true unless you were, you know.
100%. It's called Angry White Pajamas. Can't remember the author. Melissa, maybe you can find out for us why Francis Angry White Pajamas while we're waffling. But really good story about a dude who found himself kind of out of his depth and feeling a bit insecure and inadequate in Japan, having watched a gentleman be assaulted and him standing idly by, not being able to do anything and feeling useless and helpless and somewhat pathetic, and decided to turn himself into a ninja of sorts. And his subsequent journey from piss weak to being
the thing to round that out was that he was an Englishman whose major as a doctorate was as English literature. So he was a book guy.
Yes.
He joined the toughest dojo in Tokyo. Overnight became, you know, headlong into that world. Great read, fantastic book.
Immersed, and it's true, and it's inspirational, and it's super interesting. So check it out. And if you do, send me a message. Yes, Melissa?
It's by Robert Twigger.
Robert Twigger. Yeah.
That's why we've got you. Well, we've got you for many more reasons, but one, because you're very good on the research. What have you been up to, mate, other than reading a lot of books and preparing for a journey?
Well, it's been an odd year, hasn't it? So I work for the ACTU, the Australian Council of Trade Unions, and I've been working with the Australian Unions on as a media director and running a lot of media campaigns around JobKeeper and JobSeeker and trying to help people keep their jobs in a really difficult time. So I sort of moved out of the sports world because I felt a bit stale and felt like I'd been swimming around in circles in the same pool for an extended period of time. And I think my frustration with that was becoming evident to the people that knew and loved me. And my other passion, as you know, Craig, is politics and issues that I care passionately about. So I thought as I turned 50, it was time that I actually did something about being more heavily involved in that area, and that's where I've ended up. So it's been challenging in a number of ways because I went back to the start in lots of ways because I've been a broadcaster my entire life, and I know that world really intimately. I know how to make radio and make content and do that stuff virtually with my eyes closed. But to work in a different world with the muggle world, not the sort of the showbiz world where I could just sort of, you know, see the bright red light turn on and just go and do it. It's had its own challenges, but it's also been really liberating at the same time.
What's some of the challenges between straddling the magical, the mystical and the muggle?
Well, you know, when you walk away from broadcasting and being somebody who's got a daily platform to express their insane, crazy and self-entitled views like you do on the radio or on the television, the ego has to be benched because you are no longer the centre of everyone's attention and you don't always have an audience.
Yeah.
And that, you know, for something that's you've become very used to, and it's, let's face it, it can be fairly intoxicating. And, you know, if you're an attention seeker like myself, it sort of feeds the beast of your ego and it's hard to walk away from. But at the same time, it means that you can disengage a little bit from having to have an opinion on everything and being in that realm of constant combat with people and having to argue a position. You know, I got really tired with having to be public about everything I thought and felt all the time. Yeah. And I didn't want to have to be that person anymore. And I don't miss that element of it, particularly in the sports world, where it feels like it can be fairly, it's all very black and white. You know, there's winners and losers and that's it, not much else in between. And, you know, the way that I approached sport broadcasting was much more about sport in the context of society and, you know, what sport means about who we are, how it reflects how we live, what it reflects about, you know, issues of race, culture, identity, economics, the environment. All those things are apparent in the way that we engage with sport. But I was on the margins of actually caring about that stuff. I don't think many other people cared much about it, even though I do think it's important. And I just felt like I was pushing the rock up the hill once too often. It was just getting a bit dull. And so I got out of there. And I don't miss it, which is strange. I don't miss I thought I'd be addicted to the daily thrill of broadcasting my entire life, but I'm not, and that's nice.
Of course, for those who don't know Francis, background working in radio and television in primarily out of Melbourne with Triple J and with SEN Sports station here in Melbourne and around Australia, and also the ABC and bit of telly on the ABC, and also more recently the New Daily or something. And it's interesting when you have a profile, which you do and you've done for a long time, is that you know, people kind of prod you and poke you sometimes to have an opinion on things that maybe either one, you don't really have a strong opinion on, or two, you don't necessarily feel compelled to share. But I remember, and I don't even want to bring up the issue, it doesn't matter what it was, but somebody sent, put a message on my timeline, and I'm nobody, right? I've got a few followers, but, and she said to me, it was a lady, and she said about this thing, you know, you need to speak up, you need to, you know, say something, da 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 da. And then she said, your silence is violence. You not saying anything are endorsing XYZ. And I'm like, well, and now you're bullying me to echo your sentiments.
Yes.
Now you're trying to coerce me and embarrass or humiliate or bully me into saying what you want me to say, which aligns with your ideology. So now you're a bully, all the best. And it, like, that kind of shit. And I'm, let's not even talk about an issue, because then people get weirded out, but let's just talk about the psychology of how people try and defend or deny or coerce. It's like, it just does my head in, because it's,
the starting point with that, Craig, is that that person didn't ask you first what you thought or what your issue or what your insight was. What they wanted was validation for their own position.
Well, they made a judgment also on me, saying your silence is violence. I'm like, fuck off. Yeah. Like, how about this? How about, I don't know who you are and I don't care what you label me. And, you know, so how do you decide? It's a bit different now because you've backed away a little bit from the spotlight, but, you know, you still got a lot of friends and followers, and if you want attention, you can get it very easily. How do you decide when to open that door and share thoughts on something that you know there's going to be a divided audience on? Like, do you go, this is a good use of my energy and time, or fuck it?
I have to be careful not to do the latter and be much better at doing the former. So my instinct is on some issues to really engage with it, because it's my kind of my job. So I work now in a role as an advocate, and, you know, as a as somebody who's, you know, hoping to achieve certain outcomes, you know, when it comes to industrial relations and work culture and work-life balance. And my big passion is, you know, bridging the gap between the inequality gap. So when those issues are apparent, I will do what I can to engage on those things. But I do have to get better at picking the moments and the platforms, because some platforms just do not lend themselves to, and I think the culture widely doesn't lend itself to nuanced conversation. And I think one of the things that I miss the most, and I think is desperately needed, is a forum where people of different views can come together and have vigorous arguments in a atmosphere of mutual respect. And that the ideas can be contested, but they're not necessarily a reflection of character. But what we have now, predominantly through social media, and I'm a big part of that, like I've got, as you said, a lot of followers like you have, is that it's easy to talk in silos, and also be judgmental of others without actually having to look them in the eye, without actually having to talk to people and try to understand a little bit about walking in their shoes, even though you might disagree with them vociferously. One of the campaigns that I worked on in the last couple of years was during the 2019 federal election, and it was in a couple of mining communities in Queensland. I was working with a couple of candidates in the federal election whose job it was to represent the best interests of people who'd worked in coal mines in central West Queensland for generations. Like, literally, families had been there for 50 to 70 years, and, you know, grandfather, father, son and daughter had worked in these mines. And to listen to their stories about the impact of the end of coal mining, what it would mean for them and their communities, and how coal mining was very much part of their identity as a community, had fed and sort of given working class people a sense of security and a place in the world for 70 to 100 years, was something to be valued. But if you listen to the people that came to that particular place in a convoy of cars here, telling everyone down south that coal mining was bad and that coal mining needed to end, and people who were involved in coal mining were involved in murdering the planet, that experience was not represented whatsoever in the way that the issue was dealt with. Those people turned up not wanting to talk to coal mining communities, but wanting to judge coal mining communities. And I know that coal mining is, and I think most people, in the coal light of day know that coal mining, for instance, is a technology that's on its way out. And people within the mining industry know it too. So, and mining unions. So I've got nothing but great respect for the people in the mining unions that I've dealt with at the highest level, who understand that a transition away from coal mining is going to be necessary because, all the big companies are moving away from fossil-based fuels. It's going to happen, but we've got to take these communities with us. But the conversation was simply about coal mining evil, everything, and green energy good. Make your choice.
Yeah.
You can't hold both thoughts as at the same time as true and evident. It's one or the other. Mm. And it was really revelatory that people, the thing that was most depressing was that the people who came to that particular community who held that view about coal mining honestly believed they were doing the right thing on behalf of the planet, and that the consequences of what they were doing far outweighed the impact it was going to have on these particular communities. And that struck me as a disconnect, that they didn't realise that the damage that was being done to generations of families who for whom this was their life. You can't do both. You have to be able to do both. You have to be able to take people on that journey. So that's a little example of how we've lost the ability to deal with difficult issues in a environment of mutual understanding. And we're not always going to hold hands and be able to walk together, on these issues, but we've got to try. And that's what I'm hoping that I have to remind myself to be more in that mind frame than the other, which is combative. And, I love a fight, Craig. So
I do know that.
Well, I train myself not to be a fighter as much as I want to be.
And pursuant to that, Your Honor, I think one of the challenges, period, for humans is to be, like, we all love to think, and this is a thing I talk about a lot with audiences and people, is the challenge, dare I say, the almost impossibility of objectivity and open-mindedness, because everyone has got pre-existing ideas and beliefs and values and programming and conditioning and training, and all of that shit goes everywhere with me. So even me, who talks about psychology and human behavior a lot, when people go, well, are you open-minded? And I go, no, I want to be, and I try to be as open-minded as I can, but do I have pre-existing bias and prejudice and beliefs and values? I do, but what's good is I'm aware of them and I work with them and against them as much as I can. And I think people get a little bit hysterical when you say, I understand, for example, something like I understand road rage. Mm. Well, not to confuse I understand it with I support it or endorse it or partake in it, right? We're talking about an abhorrent behavior, and we're talking about the understanding of that. Like, I understand drug abuse because I've worked with lots of addicts and alcoholics. I hate drug abuse and I hate what damage it does, but I understand that that's a part of the human experience for many. So I think the starting point to be able to have respectful conversations with people who have different opinions is to go, well, we don't think the same and that's okay. And we don't need, neither of us need to win this. This is not a competition, but let me try and understand you, not necessarily align or agree with you, but understand you nonetheless. And also perhaps you, me.
That's the gap, isn't it? That we're no longer wanting to have to walk that mile forward to somebody else's position and try and understand. And I take what you mean. And the only way to learn is to understand. So when you say, for instance, about road rage, I knew what you meant. You understand the impulse, and you understand, where that energy comes from, that someone might feel that. That's the only way to really address it, is to understand where it comes from.
Well, you can't overcome what you don't understand, can you? You can't. Exactly. You can't defeat an enemy that you don't know what they're about, whatever the enemy is, be it real or imaginary.
Yeah. So, and it's unfortunate that there is a certain instinct within people to condemn or to endorse, and that's all there is. Understanding is a bit harder because there are a lot of grey areas in that about the way we behave as human beings, and You know, and to understand is not to exempt people from responsibility or consequence. And, you know, that's where we need to be. That's the only way we get better at what we do, whatever it is that we want to do. And, yeah, it's the same in sport. It's true in sport as anything else. You know, unless you understand the reason why a game plan failed or you didn't perform in a way you wanted to at a high, you know, a moment of high intensity in a contest, or, you know, you got the tactics wrong in a particular game, or, you know, you didn't perform with the energy you want. So you got to understand why. You can't just say, well, I performed badly, I'll do better next time, because unless you find the roadmap to the reasons why, there's every risk you'll do it again. And so that understanding is the key to, you know, getting better at what we do.
And the great thing about humans is we're emotional. The terrible thing about humans is we're emotional. You know, that's the bittersweet. And in the middle of that, especially when you're passionate about a thing, then it's very difficult to be strategic or logical or rational, you know, or objective when you are emotionally and socially and behaviorally and cognitively invested in a tribe that you belong to, be that the vegan tribe or the CrossFit tribe or a particular religious tribe or political tribe or what, or a sporting tribe, doesn't matter. So the challenge of being, I think some people think being objective or being open-minded is analogous to being weak or flawed.
Or having a lacking conviction.
Yes.
And therefore lacking, if you lack conviction, then you lack an impulse to act and you don't have a strong direction with which you're prepared to take and actually, you know, plant your flag in the sand with your values. Look, I'm combative as anyone when it comes to some issues. I'll fully admit that. And there are times when I'm ready for a fight, but at the same time, I hunger for the opportunity to have a more civil discourse. I know that sounds like a mouthful, but I think it's missing in lots of ways. And it's a shame. I know from my experience with the union movement last year during the start of the pandemic, and there was a lot of collaboration between unions and business groups to try and find a way through. And for the most part, it worked. In the end, it sort of, without getting into the details, it sort of once again fell back into tribalism and partisan politics. But there were real moments of understanding and all that from two disparate sides, that, you know, usually in combat between labour and capital. And it can happen. It's not going to be the answer, because there are competing and separate interests. But there is some common ground to be shared, and I think the outcomes when you can find that common ground are significant and they're worthwhile. Even in our personal lives, just trying to understand other people's points of view, what motivates them, what demotivates them, and not expecting everyone to walk around with the same set of values and do what we think is best to live a meaningful and satisfying life. You only get one pair of shoes to walk in. And sometimes you can think they're the only pair of shoes that matter, and that's not the case.
You mentioned values, which is interesting, because I literally, the word I wrote on my page, which I could show you, I even wrote it in a little square right there, is values. And then you said values. So for me, our values are kind of our internal sat nav. You know, for me, my values are the things that kind of are my guidance system for life and relationships and work and how I treat people. And, you know, and I don't always align with my values. Sometimes I'm a fuckwit and a fraud, but I try to. What's your value system? Or perhaps better question is, where does it come from? Like, I know you have strong values and I know you're passionate. Is that a byproduct of your journey, or is that who you are? Is that nurture or nature for you?
I would think that it's predominantly nurture and experience.
Right.
Because what drives me has been experience. So it's, you know, growing up where I did, growing up in a circumstance where I come from very little and from a background where disadvantage was the norm. Where intergenerational poverty was the norm, where going to jail was the norm for lots of people in my family and those that I grew up with, and trying my best from then on to change that circumstance. Not because you know, to give people an opportunity, a better opportunity to be able to reach their full potential in a way that they don't, given the straitened circumstances they find themselves growing up in and they're born into. So I get a sense from that's my experience, and that's the sort of value set that I inherited from others in my family who were also involved in political activity as well, that mattered, that really matters, and it still matters to that community and to those people. And the other side of that is also, you know, from, you know, growing up in a family with strong women and understanding the struggles and sacrifices they've had to make along the journey that far outstrip anything that the men in my family ever had to do, and my admiration and love for their achievements because of that, knowing just how hard it's been for them, has probably informed my approach to issues of gender violence, gender inequality, which I feel very deeply about, very naturally about it. It's not even a question for me when it comes to the big issue of the day. When we're talking about issues of gender, that seems to me to be something I feel very deeply and very keenly, because I see it in my mother and my sisters and other people I grew up with who have achieved great things against the odds, but deserve better. Mm. And my natural sense of what's right and wrong tells me that I've got a role to play in trying to shift the needle on that stuff. So I would say it's mostly that. It's experience. If I was born into a different circumstance, maybe a more middle-class experience, more privilege, I don't know if I'd have the same set of values. I'd imagine I'd like to think I did in an abstract sense, but the lived experience in the end is what gets you out of bed every day, even on days when you're not feeling great, and makes you want to actually participate and to do whatever you can, what little thing you can, to make it better, because you know what it's like to walk around with that stone in your shoe. And so I think that's it, Craig. I think it comes from lived experience for me.
Yeah.
What about you?
Yeah, I think I'm a byproduct of largely of my journey and, you know, where I've been and what I've done and what I've seen and what I've been through. And my life has been on no level disadvantaged or bad, or, and my challenges were on the challenge scale. Mine were really a one or two. When you've got no context and you're a fat 14-year-old, they feel like they're a nine on the scale.
But they are. I mean, you shouldn't under, but that's it. Your lived experience is no less traumatic or difficult because somebody else's might be more intense or more extreme. It is your lived experience. So
yeah. But I think I almost feel guilty sometimes when I look back and I think about my, in inverted commas, challenges, and I go, fucking get a real challenge, get a real problem, because I work with people now, as do you, and connect with people that have got, you know, problems that made my problems look ridiculous, look like non-events. But I think context, but what that does do now is what, you know, like I think, you know, I work with a guy, I've been coach training him for 3 years, who got blown up in an accident and was told, his family was told he'd die, then he'd be brain dead essentially, or very, very limited cognitive function if he lived, and he'd be a quadriplegic. And I've been training him for nearly 3.5 years, and he's just the most resilient, positive, amazing human. And he has more challenges each day than I've had in the totality of my life, you know. So you get that where you just go, I always say to Melissa, if I complain, kick me in the dick, because I'm the problem, right? My life is awesome, you know. So how old are you now, mate?
53. Deep middle age. There's no getting away from it. I can't hide.
Dude, you're on the downward slide, but you and I are just sliding together side by side in toboggans like two old fuckwits. Are you getting more philosophical? Are you getting more angry? Are you getting more?
Yeah, great question.
What's going on?
Yeah. I'd like to think I'm getting more philosophical. I'd like to think I do get angry sometimes. I think that's, and there's, I think there's a lot to be angry about. And I don't think that anger is necessarily unhealthy, because there's a lot to be angry about. Inequality in Australia is greater than it's ever been. Disadvantage is greater than it's ever been. We've never been a more wealthy country. So there's lots in that sphere to get angry about. But I do think I'm getting more philosophical and my day-to-day living. And, you know, it's little things like being in traffic. And, you know, if someone cuts you off, you know, it might have been a time, talk about road, but there might have been a time when you got angry and got, oh, you fucking idiot, you know. Now I just go, back off, just, there's no point, nothing can change, just don't be that guy, just get to your destination and let it pass. And that sort of cognitive behavioral approach of things, going, you know what, that guy was a dickhead, but there's going to be another one down the road, whatever. You know, so I think I'm getting better at not sweating the little things as much as I used to.
Do you think you're more, sorry to interrupt, so my PhD is on self-awareness. Do you think you're more self-aware? Do you ever, sorry to ask you all these curly ones, but it just, I'm literally fucking fascinated with this stuff and you're one of the smartest people I know. So I like asking you, do you think you have an awareness of self, and do you ever think about your thinking?
Yeah, all the time. All the time, every morning. Yeah, totally. And I learned that from you, Craig. And I learned that from you also by using training as a sort of meditative space. And I mean, you're the one that taught me the value of daily training. And even though I sort of do it on my own now, I do it regularly. I'm about to go and have a bit of a session after this. That's the space where I do a lot of that thinking, where I think about how I've spoken to people today, how I've approached people today, how I can be better at what I do. You know, really questioning myself, not trying to justify my behavior. I think you and I and others were sort of self-aware, know when we've been rude or dismissive or we've taken the piss out of someone when we probably should. We know those moments if we're true to ourselves. Mm. And also those moments when we need to reach out to people and make sure that they're okay. Because, you know, we might see someone who's not feeling well, or we know something's going on in their life, that you actually make a conscious decision to engage, to assist, or just to be that to sustain people. So I'd like to think that I'm more self-aware about that stuff. I don't just bounce from one moment to the next and just enjoy the good times and forget about the tough ones. I hope so. And I, you know, it's important to be that. You know?
Yeah. I remember when I was
it's really satisfying, don't you think, when you are? Like, you just feel like you're...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always say my biggest project's me. Like, yeah. I'm the project. Like, my life is pretty good. Like, it, you know, there's nothing really, I mean, there's nothing that needs to change. I'm very blessed, fortunate, lucky, fill in the blank, whatever. Yeah. What do you think you're going to be doing over the next 1, 2, 5 years?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not so sure. I'll keep doing this for a while, I think. I've actually really enjoyed this year because I've gone from managing a team of people on a number of projects just back to, this is interesting, this is sort of self-awareness. So as I was going along, I sort of got drawn into managing little teams of people in this area, which was fine because I'm okay at that, and, you know, managing projects and timelines and doing that sort of work. But what I missed was actually communication and writing and you know, and content, you know, like creating. And so I just said to the guys that I work for, look, I think you're not getting the best out of me, and what I'm best at is that creative element. So I'm going to step back from the managerial role, because it just seems that you're on that treadmill to progression. The only way you get, you know, more successful in any sector is to become management. Mm. And that's how you get paid more. That's how you get more responsibility. It's all the status bullshit that goes with that. Well, actually, I had a taste of that and it was okay, but I really missed just being the creative content producer, producing stuff, communicating with people, thinking. So I sort of took a step back, and now that's what I do full time, is just provide. I go back to being the creative, and it's not, and it's, I'm getting paid a little bit less. I'm not involved in the sort of big strategic discussions that used to go on, that part of it I really enjoyed, but I'm much happier. And it's sort of accepting that that's what I'm good at, and that's okay. I'm a radio broadcaster. I'm a journalist. I'm a writer. I'm a content maker, and that's okay. It doesn't need to be. I want to be better at that. I want to get better at what I do. I want to continue to learn. I want to understand better as technology changes what the needs of an audience might be, or how better to serve the needs of people when they're listening, reading, or watching. But I don't want to do. I don't want to put on a suit and tie necessarily and become the manager guy. And you know, that was a nice bit of self-discovery over the last year or two. I thought that was the way to be a grown-up, and actually, I quite like being this kind of grown-up.
See, I think the interesting thing about you, knowing you pretty well, I just wrote down there 4 things that I think you are on a cognitive level, like what you need for your brain, because a lot of people are very intellectual or very creative. You're both. So you're intellectual, you're creative, you're analytical, and you're also inspirational. Like, your brain is not typical, and I'm not pumping up your tires, but
I go right ahead, Craig. I'm enjoying this bit.
No, but you're very analytical. You're also very intellectual. You can deconstruct things, but then you have this ability to reconstruct it in a user-friendly way.
Well, that's what I love doing.
Do you know what I mean? It's like, here's something that's a bit overwhelming. Let me just kind of let's Francisify it. Let's just not dumb it down, but let's make it digestible so we all know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and that's kind of what I try and do with human behavior and psychology and neuroscience is try to go, look, here's, I can give you the full goss if you want, but fucking trust me, you don't want it. Yeah, let me give you the fucking Reader's Digest version. You know, I can tell everyone about
it. It's easier to read more. It's got a more ripping yarns.
I can take you on my 4-year PhD journey, or I can give you the 1-minute snapshot. Trust me, you want the snapshot. You know, because you don't need to know the 4 years.
You do all that work to be able to break it down into one sentence.
100%.
Someone's got to build the ladder so that everyone else can climb up the top and have a look.
And I think for you, you kind of go down either the intellectual or the analytical rabbit hole, and then you get this almost tap on the shoulder from the creative part of your brain going, let's go and do something fun and different and explorative.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's not, you're just not a one-trick pony. If you're, you know, which is why, like you were talking before about, you know, like I also wrote down politics and music and sport and working with people who are disadvantaged. There's four components of who you are and how you are that I strongly recognize in you. And for you to, you know, alternate between a full on deep political space to music, it's like, that's just like so not related to sport.
Well, I do write some music stuff again. I've gone back to doing a bit of that as well, which I've really enjoyed. Because, as you know, I spent a lot of time working in the music side of things. And, I've actually started writing songs again and might be making a record later this year for the first time in 30 years, which I should have brought that up earlier. Hey. That creative side of me, that's a fascinating one. I'm running out of time. But, a good friend of mine, I grew up with Ash Naylor, who's in a band called Even, plays guitar in Paul Kelly's band. He's in the church as well these days. In fact, he's playing his very first gig with the church this week after he joined the band 2 years ago. And because of COVID, he hasn't been able to play with them, but they're on tour. He and I were in a band together as kids. And throughout the lockdown, we just started swapping ideas and talking about the records we were listening to, because what else are you going to do while you're sitting around in your pajamas?
Yeah.
And then put a couple of LPs on the turntable. And he gently sort of pushed me into writing songs again. Consistently said, you should do it. So I sent him a couple of ones that I wrote, said, if this is really shit, just tell me. So I'm not wasting your time, because you're now Australia's best guitarist and you don't need to be playing with a fourth division plonker like me. And he goes, no, this is really good. So we got together and we've written a bunch of songs that sort of opened up the floodgates. And now I'm always learning, Craig. I've even gone back to take singing lessons. I do that once a week with to get better at that, so that I can enjoy that more, and also be better at it when I record my songs. So,
I'm excited about that, and I don't want to make you jealous, but we did have Mark Seymour on recently, and he did
I think
sing.
His songs have got a bit more to offer than mine.
What's that?
I think his songbook's a bit stronger than mine.
Oh no, it's a touch and go.
Touch and go.
And he did sing live during the podcast.
I saw it. It was great.
So good for him. He's a good man. Well, mate, we love chatting to you. You're an inspiration, and I know you've got to go and do stuff, but if people want to connect with you or follow you or, you know, stalk you.
Frankly, on Twitter is probably the easiest way to go. So at SAINTFRANKLY. I don't know. I picked that name about 11 years ago and it sort of stuck. So that's where you find me. I just search my name on the Twitters, and that's where I usually pop up.
All right, mate. We love you. Stay on the call for 1 second if you would. Thanks, everyone. Love your guts. Thanks, Frankie.
See you, mate.